RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
In a discreet cul-de-sac, just a short walk away from the hubbub of London's Shepherd's Bush, is the headquarters of one of Britain's best-known fashion designers. Established over two decades ago, she is known for her understated and relaxed style, using a combination of natural fabrics, patterns and textures, often collaborating with leading textile designers. She designs for major high street retailers and her own label, both here in the UK and internationally. She is Betty Jackson.
Well, first off, I just wanted to say, Betty, many congratulations on the CBE and the Queen's Birthday Honours List.
Thank you.
Which follows on from your MBE in 87.
Yeah.
So I would think that that makes you, in fashion terms, using that old cliche, a national treasure.
Hideously so. Hideous, of course, to be a national treasure. You know, one would hate to be a national treasure, I think. Except I was rather pleased because it was such a shock. When you get one, you think that's sort of it. So it's quite nice to have this sort of upgrade, really, I suppose. So
what's the procedure? Do they send you a letter and ask
they
you
send you a
accept
letter,
or
yeah,
not?
Yeah, they send you a letter and you think it's a tax return. You think it's a really serious tax return because it comes from Downing Street. So you think you've done something really bad. And then it sort of, you know, tells you that everybody has it in mind to suggest to Her Majesty and all of that. And then they say that you've got to keep the whole thing completely confidential and you sort of, you know, with the threat of going to the Tower and having your head chopped off. So you have to sort of not tell anybody whilst you're sort of squeaking with saying, oh, goodness, you know, And then you sort of rather forget about it. So it's another shot when the whole thing comes out and everybody.
And then when will it actually be? When is the?
Well, then poor Her Majesty, Mom, poor thing, has to sort of start sometime now, I think she starts. Except then she has the summer off and she starts and she does all of them right through till November. So
your stuff will be.
I don't know. I don't know whether they do it alphabetically or I think they just have a random clutch, you know. And the last time I went, when I went for the first one, it was in October. But that's also rather nice because once you've done it once, I mean, I was so petrified the first time, but actually now I sort of know what to expect. And, you know, one has met and been there, you know, several times now in my long geriatric career anyway, and so it's rather nice to sort of know, you know, this will be. I just remember the band was playing The Hills Are Alive with the Sound of Music last time I went. Sorry.
Well, that brings us right up to date, but yes. Now I'm going to yes. Flashback and I want to go back to your childhood. You were born in Lancashire and I really wanted to know whether within your family, mother, father, siblings, whether there was a creative sort of flame that.
No, my mother was very elegant and beautiful and always wore good clothes, but there's no design element here. I mean, I think she would have been a historian had it not been for the war, but that's my only link, really. I mean, she did, you know, she always looked fantastic and they entertained quite a lot and I remember in the school holidays we used to go off to Kendal Milne, which was a day trip to Manchester from where we were, for her to sort of look at the clothes for the next season. And I remember vividly sitting in the restaurant with my sister and models walking past with numbers on their wrists, and then my mother would go and try them on.
So this would be in the mid-50s? Mid to late 50s?
But very few, mid-50s, but very few. She didn't have loads, you know, I mean, there was a very sort of northern aspect to this, in which case it would be just one good suit and one winter coat, and you know, which is, I think, what everybody had back then. That's the only link. There's no real design or art, so I'm a complete charlatan, you see.
that you drew as a child?
I did draw as a child. I sort of was good at art, in inverted commas, and was encouraged to be good at art as well. Although, you know, limited art education then, you used to sort of draw bowl of fruit and learn about perspective, and that was sort of it.
But you were encouraged by your parents or by your teacher?
It was something that I excelled in, so, you know, there was within my parents' friends, you know, I used to draw children of other people's friends, you know, I used to do portraits of them, you know, because I could get a likeness and stuff like that, really. Yeah. But it wasn't really, I didn't ever draw frocks in my margins or anything like that. I never really thought I would be. And then through my adolescence was, you know, the roaring 60s when I just wanted to look like my best friend and marry John Lennon. You know, that was sort of the extent of the fashion involvement because we were so removed from fashion.
Yes, I suppose, I mean, you know, I'm of a similar vintage. Mm. And I think the, you know, the 60s was that amazing coming together. Mm. Not only of design in all forms, but also the kind of breakdown of the class structure to a certain extent, insofar as, generally speaking, I mean, I lived in the south of England, and you would very rarely hear a northern accent, apart from Wilfred Pickles.
Mm. And Gracie Fields.
And Gracie Fields, and they were kind of, you know, they had adapted their accents. But the explosion of Liverpool Sound and poets and all of that suddenly changed all of that, and I think people at that stage actually thought, well, there's a real opportunity here. I mean, how did that affect you, and how did you then go
on? I never thought about this north-south divide, I don't think, and maybe because I was at the other end. But coming from a very small village, I sort of knew that I would have to leave. I knew there was a sort of desire to get out, I think, and I knew that I would have to go south, and I only managed it bit by bit. But I think I was really well aware that everything was happening. When Liverpool and everything happened, and there was a focus on the north, but it still wasn't good enough. Then everybody moved to the south. You know, whatever was produced from the south. The fact that, you know, they came from Liverpool was sort of irrelevant. Mm. You know, the Beatles came to play at Rorton Stall Astoria, you know, but so did the Troggs, and so did the Freddie and the Dreamers, and all of those people. And you never thought about the difference. All I knew was that one had to gravitate southwards, really. Mm.
Me then, what happened to make you decide that you wanted to pursue an art college?
It was by elimination, and I sort of was one of those people who knew what I didn't want to do rather than what I did. And it came to the point, you know, where you send in your ACCA form, and I was supposed to go to university and read English and history, and didn't really have a problem with exams either, you know, went to sort of a very academic grammar school, and so it was a foregone conclusion that that was what I was going to do. And I don't know, I just had a brainstorm and said, knew I would die if I went to pursue this. And said, went to see the headmistress and said, I don't want to fill this in. And she said, why not? And I said, well, because the first thing that came into my head, literally, it was a sort of Damascus moment, where I'm going to go to art college. And I honestly don't know where it came from.
Did you know anyone else?
No. I didn't know anybody, and I just knew that I didn't want to go to university and just write essays and learn zillions of facts, and I knew there was something else. Mm. And so then that was a bit of a problem because, you know, you didn't do this thing. I mean, the nearest to creativity was, because we were so near Manchester, the Halley Orchestra, you know, and things that were happening in Manchester. And I just said I was going to go to art college, and my parents were really very supportive almost immediately. And my father said, okay, if you want to go to art college, then you go to art college. And so he obviously asked around and rang a few people and said, you're going to go to Rochdale Art College, which was so, my heart sank, because it was 6 miles down the road and I had to just get on a double-decker bus from here. Why, all of my friends went off to Oxford and Cambridge and London and Surrey University, and, you know, and it was fantastic. And I'd sort of thought that at least I might get as far as Hornsey, where there was a sit-in happening, yeah, you know, yeah. And that's what I wanted to be part of. Anyway, that wasn't going to happen, so... But the most, and he said quite rightly, I mean, he was obviously quite a wise man, and he said quite rightly, you know, if this is really what you want to do, you go for a year, and if it's not, we'll catch up, and, you know, obviously you'll come to your senses sort of thing, and we can follow plan A. The moment I got to Rochdale, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. I knew absolutely that I'd made the right decision. Still not necessarily to do with fashion, but actually to do with the sort of people that were there. And not anything really to do with wildness, you know. There was just a mentality, and it was fantastic. Yeah. And it was a tiny little college. And then, just to sort of move on, really, there was this couple that worked there, Mr. and Mrs. Booth, who were, you know, quite elderly, but the thing that they had done, they'd travelled extensively, and so they'd been to the Vine. They'd got this huge library of fantastic fabrics, you know, from all over the world, antique ones, modern ones, new ones, you know, and it was just, it was absolutely amazing. Mm. And I just fell in love with fabric there. And that's really what did it. I didn't care that I was only in Rochdale. I didn't care. I knew that it was sort of right.
So the entering Rochdale School of Art, the course was fashion?
It was a foundation course.
Foundation course. So we did really
There's a month in lithography, okay. A month in sculpture, yep. And a month in, yep. You know, and it was fantastic.
And you discovered fabrics.
And I discovered art. Discovered, you know, I didn't know. You know, A-level art at that time literally was, you know, drawing a scene that you made up in your head. Mm. And then you drew still life. That's what you submitted for your art A-level.
So then a year on, you obviously told your parents that this was the place for you.
I think they knew fairly early on.
Plan B was very much...
out.
Yeah. So you then applied, obviously...
To Birmingham.
To Birmingham, and that's where you started in 68.
Yeah, and then, because that's... again, my dad said, you know, I can, if there's something goes wrong, I can get down there and scoop you up. Sounds like I come from a hideous family. They weren't, of course, but anyway. And also Birmingham was a very new college, and it was fantastically well equipped. And there was this music thing that was happening there too, which was really great, you know, Chicken Shack and the Moody Blues and all of that. Mm. So there was a link there as well. And so that's where I went.
And you were there for three years.
Yeah.
And so that was the fashion course.
Yeah.
And you obviously developed your illustration skills and honed them. Mm. Because after that you became
an illustrator.
Freelance fashionist. So you were visualizing for others.
For other people, yeah.
And then in 73, you joined fashion designer
Wendy
Dagworthy, who's now, I think, head of fashion at the Royal College. And you also, a little later, I mean, you actually became a part-time tutor yourself at the Royal College.
Tell
me a little bit about Wendy, because she said that when you first met, I think you were... It was via Lynn Franks,
was that right?
PR guru,
I think.
And you were apparently wearing, as it was described, a retro raincoat with the collar turned up, like a 1930s movie star.
I don't remember that at all.
Perfect, I must say.
Yes, it certainly does.
And it kind of leads me on to wondering Because I've noticed in other little things I've read about you, you've mentioned other movie stars, whether that whole world of movies has been a big influence on you.
I'm sure. I think when one's in something as visual as fashion, you know, one trawls, really, you know, remorselessly and relentlessly, really. And also, you know, things that are very stimulating. I still look at film. I don't look at old movies anymore. Well, that's not true. I mean, old movies are constantly stimulating, you know, but on a different level. Mm. But I still look at film. No, I think it's fantastically stimulating, and of course it's moving, and you know, and they are people wearing clothes, and you can see what happens to fabrics and all of that. That's maybe a bit too technical, but you know, there's a lot to look at and a lot to. I think that then you jumble it all together and it comes out as something else.
Sure. Going back for a moment to your experience, your early experience with Wendy, how was that? How did you find it? Because it was quite a small.
Yeah, really, there's just the two of us. Yeah. Yes, me and her.
That's right.
And I think I really.
And you were the driver.
Yeah, I think I got the job because I could drive and she couldn't. But we literally did meet, and within 3 days she rang me up because she needed help. She'd started her little business after working for a while out of college for a company called Radley. So in fact it was very funny because we did things in reverse. And she then had started up her own business, but her collection was very, very small, and of course London wasn't organised at all. She was incredibly brave to start it up on her own. And literally we used to sell to small independent boutiques around London, and you know, I'd drive and we'd get the collection out the back of the car and go into places on Beecham Place. And there was a wonderful shop called Elle that was run by a wonderful woman called Maureen Doherty, who runs Egg now, the shop Egg. And she was the manager, and we used to sell to her. And it was very, very small, and we used to take the orders down, rush home, make them and deliver them within 3 weeks. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And there was a little network of machinists who, you know, used to make things for us, and I sort of used to whiz around North London. And
so these were out workers?
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, we used to, I think we probably went off for lunch every day, and, you know, we went to see a film some afternoons, and it was good fun, you know.
And how much did you get involved with hands-on design at that stage?
It was very much, very definitely Wendy's company. Yeah. I was absolutely the assistant, and, you know, and we used to work on some things together, but it was her company and her look and her thing, and I was the support act, very, very definitely, and I was with her for 2 years.
Yes, and after that, which was obviously a very good, gentle initiation into watching someone firsthand with her own label, albeit tiny, you then moved on to join Ozzie Clark
Quorum,
and Celia Brightwell at Forum. At Quorum, and I mean, Ozzie Clark and Celia Brightwell at that time were quite beautiful people.
I mean, maybe. I mean, Celia wasn't there when I went there. She joined. Well, she had been there, obviously, but you know, there was Ozzie. Definitely, Ozzie was, and also Sheridan Barnett and Sheila Brown, Mary France. Right, there was a whole. I mean, really, Quorum was the first label to actually give a label to somebody else. You know, it was a stable of designers, and they used to present all these different collections. And they rang me up one day, and we got to a stage, I think, when Wendy had joined this group of designers called the New Wave, which were starting to get themselves together to show collectively in a hotel and invite buyers, international buyers from across the world, as well as, you know, people like Harvey Nichols and Selfridges and, you know, and all of that, to come and see the collection. So she was very much on a good foundation by then, you know, and there were lots of people who wanted to wear. I mean, Wendy was a very glamorous lady, and there were lots of people who wanted to wear her clothes, and it was sort of probably time for me to move on, really. I had done what I could, and all she really needed was an assistant to organise her and help her. And anyway, so that's why I went to Quorum. Also,
now, how did you find Quorum?
It was very different because I was put in a room and expected to come up with a collection by the end of the week. You know what I mean? It was very, very different. But I did learn a lot. I was there for 6 years.
Mm. And so you were designing, but it was under the auspices of...
It was Betty Jackson for Quorum.
It was Betty Jackson for Quorum.
Yeah, and I was supposed to be alongside Ozzy and Ozzy, because I was very definitely day wear and casual, and, you know, and Ozzy was doing his beautiful evening, you know. And also it was quite difficult to get Ozzy to work at those days, you know. He would maybe come in for a couple of afternoons and then you knew about it, but... I don't think he spoke to me for the first 3 months I was there. You know, he used to pass me in the corridor and, you know, used to sort of just pass me in the corridor. And that was it, really. So, you know, it was very well known that he was the star and one knew one's place, you know, which was also, it's also a good lesson to learn. Mm.
And I think he attached many celebrities around him and who wore his clothes at the time and was always featured in Nova and magazines like that. At the time.
And he had, I mean, I believe he was a genius. I do believe he was a genius. I mean, we got, when we did finally get to talk to each other, he was really nice. And we used to go across to the Picasso restaurant in King's Road and he was a troubled character. But David Hockney always said that, you know, the trouble with Ozzy, he forgot to work. He forgot that he should work. And I think that's what, you know, that's the difference between somebody like David Hockney who continues for it to be his main focus. And Ozzy had become distracted by the external trappings of the whole thing. You know, easy to do, but So
after that, I mean, you obviously built up an enormous amount of experience.
I did. I mean,
enough to start your own company.
Yeah, I mean, well, then you know, they were splitting the company, and I could have stayed with them, but I also could have gone. So that's when I met. I just met David, my
husband
now, and really he said, well, why don't we do it on our own, really? Why can't we do it by ourselves?
So your husband's profession?
He was involved in he's French, and he was involved in a family business in Marseille.
Nothing to do with fashion.
Could
he have a business side to it
that he could...
You could see
and we just liked the idea of working together, and so that's what we did.
And what were those early days like?
Fantastic.
How many people did you have around you?
Four, I think. Yeah.
And where did
big
you start?
Team.
Where were you? Yeah.
We were in a basement in Meard Street that was lent by a friend of mine. Opposite the brothel. It was great. They helped us move it in. It was fantastic, all these machinery. And used to hang out of the window saying, oh, I saw you on telly last night, babe. And there was a great, we were right in the thick, and it was fantastic. It was very exciting. I mean, I think it was really hard work. It's still hard work. You know, it is very hard work. Mm. But It sort of went meteoric, really. It was sort of alarming, really.
So tell me, how rapidly did you sort of expand and move?
81 we started, and I think we moved out within a year because, you know, we needed space. And we moved to Hanway Street, just north of Oxford Street. And then from there we bought a building in Tottenham Street, which was also in Fitzrovia, which is an area that we love. And I had lived in Riding House Street anyway, so I knew the area. And David loved the coffee from Bar Italia, and you know, everything was in walking distance, and you know, lovely Charlotte Street. It was great, and it was sort of euphoric because, of course, when you there were a lot of people within the industry who'd known the collection when I'd done it for Quorum and had seen it, obviously, but I was very much a backseat because Ozzy was the star. And we're interested to see what I was going to do on my own, really.
Sure.
And so we already had some sort of audience who knew the sort of thing I had. And I don't know whether that gave us a bit of a leg up or what, but it was extraordinary. I mean, within two seasons, it was... I mean, I remember we went to show... By this time, London was vaguely organised. We showed in Olympia, and there was... It wasn't called London Fashion Week, but there was an exhibition of designers who all sort of haphazardly came together. And we got this collection done and hung up on the rail. And the exhibition opened and we sort of sat down, you know, breathing a sigh of relief. There was myself and sample machinist and the pattern cutter who were working with me, and David was there, and we sort of breathed a sigh of relief, you know, sort of sat down and said, oh, right, it's finished now, I can relax. And literally... Geraldine Jones from Harrods, who's the biophone worker, walked in around the corner, went flick, 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 and then said, oh, I'd like to do an order. Well, we were so taken aback, we hadn't even got an order book. We had to rush out and get a, you know, one of those Xerox, you know, blue books to write the order down, because it hadn't occurred to us that anybody would want to order. That's how stupid we were at the beginning. But within two seasons, we were banging on NatWest door saying we've got all these orders and we need help, because I'd spent David's money very quickly, I'm afraid. So we did, that's how we did it, and everybody was you know, they paid us within 10 days. We said, we can't deliver, we can't make the stuff unless you pay us. David kept all of that under control, or notwithstanding him speaking French the whole time and me having to translate, and it was, you know, it's sort of what we did. It was, and we were part of an emerging youth, I think, or youthful designers that really, you know, took the whole world by storm. I mean, it was not only here, but it was... In fact, the biggest success was in America. You know, here we were treated as if we had two heads. People were very, very cautious about all these new... I mean, then I was alongside Wendy. There were people like Bodymap, Catherine Hamnett... You know, Catherine was established by then because she was already up, you know, fantastically successful. So I sort of joined this group of people who, you know, it was just extraordinary. It was just, we had people just chucking banker's drafts at us saying, you know, fill it in and send it. Oh, it was amazing. I think because of several different reasons. First of all, there was no other young fashion available. Milan was still, you know, Armani and Fendi and all of those very beautiful, but his vision was still quite controlled, you know. I mean, he was slashing hemlines and he was taking interfacing out, but it wasn't really what you would say a youthful vision. Mm. We broke all the rules, I think, the group of us, you know, we... printed bold prints that, you know, were never repeated in the same place. We had ridiculous accessories. We all had pink hair, you know, with tassels hanging off, you know. We looked, somebody once said to me, I looked like one of those games you play at Christmas where you cover it up and then you have to remember how many things are on the tray. Well, that's what we all looked like.
This would have been the period where soft shoulder pads were very
enormous shoulder pads. Yes, you know, you had to go through doors sideways. Yes. You know, it was...
I find that, because that was such a stark memory, you know, because every pop star...
Duran.
Everyone had...
Well, Wendy was making... Yeah,
and I just... I don't think there's been a style or fashion since that period was so kind of overt.
Oh, I think punk came, you know, very quickly afterwards and was a different movement. But actually, I mean, everybody had slick white hair. And, you know, the next thing
it's moving into, well, it's an associated topic, but you're moving on to punk, as you were saying. It's quite interesting that if you think about that period and you think about what was going on in pop music and fashion, there was a point at which a lot of people felt everything was overproduced. Music was overproduced. Mm. There were these big rock concerts where you couldn't see anyone. And then suddenly there was this, not only in fashion, but in graphics too. Graphics were overproduced. You know, everything was printed in 6-7 colours with double varnish and God knows what it is. Yeah. They're all working together. Yeah. Suddenly someone started sticking things down with an antidote to design. And it seemed to spin off into lots of other areas. And so what I always find fascinating about design is that they are always interconnected. And if you pretend that they're not, it's crazy. Now, obviously, when looking back, you can see clear links. But at that time, how did that sudden collision
I think, you know, you never work in a vacuum. You know, I think to be a designer, you have to be in touch with whatever zeitgeist. Well, you have to predict almost, really. You have to sort of imagine what's going to happen next. And unless, you know, political, social, economic change is bound to affect you as a designer, because that affects your customer. And ultimately, you know, we are not a designer that just lives on press alone. You've got to sell some frocks as well. Mm. So it's either a reaction for or a reaction against something.
I want to just touch on the description of your particular fashion style, whatever you want to call it. And I don't know, you know, style is not a... I don't think it's a very nice word. Personality, I think, is a better word. And you've been described as understated, relaxed, casual, classic, and I think the British Fashion Council describe you as a directional classicist, which I'd like you to explain what you think that means.
I think we should phone them immediately and ask them to explain.
What do you think? How would you describe the personality
of your work?
It's
quite hard. It's quite hard to describe it. It is quite hard. I mean, because I do what I feel, and I... you know, and some things work and some things don't. I think it is relaxed. I hate formality, although I love a uniform. So, you know, there's an opposite there. I suppose I think it's comfortable, but that's rather sort of nerdy and fuddy-duddy. Mind you, I think there's something sexy about comfort. You know, I don't think you can be sexy if you're not comfortable, really. Yeah, yeah. So I think that word has got bad press. People often say classic. I wonder if that's to do with age rather than, you know, because I come from that generation. I don't know. It's nice that they say directional. I think that's good. One is always, you know, looking for a new silhouette or a new fabric or a new way of doing something. Mm. So that's nice. But I, as far as, you know, the philosophy is concerned, I come to a grinding halt when I'm asked to describe. Mm. I must say it's...
So, I understand what you're saying. Often it's better just not answer that and just do it. Mm. Because once you start to try and analyse where it comes from...
It goes really wrong.
It goes very wrong. Mm. I mean, it's...
And also you sound completely pompous.
Yes, yes. I mean, you've now... I mean, it's 30 years.
Really. Is it?
Yeah.
Good grief.
And now, of course, I mean, for all those years that you've had your own company, you've been on this continual seasonal collection treadmill, which must be incredibly demanding, because, you know, you have this slot that's immovable, you've got to come up with the goods.
It's also exciting, though.
Yeah, I wanted to know, I mean, obviously it takes enormous energy and a lot of commitment, but actually what it comes down to is creativity. I mean, that's... And I wanted to know, one, how do you manage to keep this kind of flame burning? Because, you know, your world, particularly the world of fashion, is... it's a bit like appearing naked in front of all those people who judge you like being an actor. Mm. For most creative people, actually, when their work is shown, it is like revealing themselves, and you wait for the criticism or the applause, whatever. And I mean, it must be very stressful. And I wondered where you get your continual inspiration. You consult with these colour predictionists, or whether you do it all yourself. I mean, I looked at some of your recent work, and I can see it's a very beautiful, sort of natural, soft ochres and greys, and very, very neutral, sort of almost earthy world. And I just, you know, it would be interesting to know how that came, where you get those sort of sources of inspiration from.
It's usually colour. Well, I also have, I mean, obviously I don't do it on my own, you know. I have a great team,
it would be very interesting to know a little bit more about that, how it operates in terms of the creative inputs.
I have three assistants who are divided up. One helps me with main range, one helps me with the diffusion range, and then there's another more junior one who sort of is the assistant to his assistant and does research and helps out. Well, in fact, her role is getting, because she's great, so her role is getting more important. And at the beginning of any collection, we start with colour, and that can be absolutely anything. We have an ongoing discussion that happens over 3-4 days. When all of us are just, you know, antennae are sort of up there working, really. And often we look at, in the run-up to that period, we see every exhibition that we possibly can, fine artists or anything. And it's often a fine artist that's inspirational about the colour. Last summer, it was Edward Hopper, because he was at the Hayward, was it?
Yes,
Tate Modern, or,
yes.
Or Tate Modern, I think it was, but anyway. And just went to see it, and I just thought it was fantastic. And I loved his colours are dark and sombre, but then, you know, with the flash of yellow.
Of red lipstick.
Yeah, I loved the atmosphere of the pictures. There was a sort of a desolation.
Very much so, yes.
But always, you know, with the hope that there's something slightly out of the picture that is happening. And
very cinematic, actually, interesting.
Maybe,
don't
yeah.
You think?
Maybe. Well, yeah, because, yeah.
I mean, many.
Many
directors
Sting
were
and
very
all of that.
Inspired. Hitchcock,
yes.
Apparently very inspired by
absolutely, well,
by
you could
Hopper.
See, yeah. And I loved the whole thought about doing really, you know, dark clothes for summer. And anyway, so that's where that one came from. But then it can be, the one before was Matisse and his gorgeous pinks and blues, you know, the winter before that. I'm trying to remember what we did for this winter, but I can't. But it did go, it went very dark again for winter. It's because I'm working on next summer now, and I've blocked winter out, really.
And of course you also have expanded into other areas. I'm thinking particularly of, you were for a time a consultant to Marks and Spencer's, and you had Autograph, collection. And then you moved on to Debenhams, and you have the black range.
Collection, yeah.
You've got your own range. Mm. You're also moving into home products as well.
For Debenhams, yeah.
For Debenhams, so you've got ceramics and so forth, I see. Mm. I think for a while you actually men's clothing, but you?
I did, very short period of time. It was really because I used to make clothes for some well-known comedians who just sort of, because we just sort of knew them, and, you know, I was sort of almost their sort of designer that they could tap into, really. And that's what started it. And then people met Lenny, and then other people asked me to do them. And then somebody said, well, why don't you, you know, do these? And we did. It was over a period of 6 months when we dressed quite a number of well-known people, and therefore we got feedback about it and said, you know, well, I'll buy it if you're going to do this. I want to buy it, and why don't we do this? And so we showed it as part of the women's collection. But it then became hideously difficult, because my idea was that you would just use exactly the same fabrics, and, you know, which is a good idea, you know, exactly the same fabrics and do exactly the same prints and knitwear and just do them in a man's way. Mm. And that's what worked. It only worked for a period of time. Mm. I think if we'd have actually been serious about it, we would have had to look into the manufacturing of men's clothes, which is entirely different, yes, from women. And we would have had to get serious about it. At that point, I had two very small children, and we were literally doing the men's collection 3 days before the show, you know, and it got that something had to give, and, you know, last in, first out, really, so we sort of stopped it.
So it kind of started out as you being a sort of, for want of a better word, a stylist for various friends.
No, I was asked to do clothes for, yes, this guy's tour.
Yes.
And
okay, so that's slightly different.
Yeah, yeah. So we made to measure, yeah, for this guy's, yeah, tour.
But on that topic, I want to move on to something which is an aside, but I think an interesting one. In recent years, there have been many, many programs about making over your house, you know, all sorts of things. And of course, then came Trini and Susanna with What Not to Wear, which at its time seemed to be a very interesting program. Got a lot of younger people interested in you know, what not to wear. But they've changed the dynamic now, and there are two programs that have been on recently. There's Trini and Susanna's Undress, and there is this chap called Gok Wan, mm-hmm, who has a program called How to Look Good Naked. Now, these programs are interesting in that it takes the process of dressing someone by first stripping them down, I mean both psychologically and physically, and rebuilding them. And through clothes, they somehow seem to transcend all of their problems and are new people. And I just wondered what you thought about these. You must have dipped into them.
Okay. Two things. First of all, it is a television program, so there's nothing real about it at all. And I am of the opinion that clothes should do a job for you, and one of the jobs they should do is make you feel better. And there's definitely a feel-good factor involved in the purchasing, the trying on, the acquisition of clothes, because it's fantastic if you buy a new dress or you buy a new jacket or you buy a great shirt that you love. You must feel the same. There is a feel-good factor. It makes you feel good. And that's where these programs for me end, because after that it's rubbish. I think it's reducing something to a lowest common denominator, really, for television. You know, it sort of shocks me, but maybe that's what the British public wants to see. I have the same view on celebrity. I've never understood why you have to see a celebrity in a frock in order to like it. I've never understood why you can't make that decision yourself. I've never understood celebrity endorsement. I know I'm particularly stupid in this respect, but I've never understood why, if somebody else has this jacket, it makes it all right for the rest of us to have it. So it's alien territory, Mike.
Yes. Well, I mean, the thing is, I think in recent years, there is so much emphasis now on celebrity. If you just look at the magazine stands, and you see that every week there's yet another magazine which seems to exist on nothing but paparazzi shots of celebrities. Or you can't not see Victoria Beckham, who seems to appear in the newspaper every day more than any other person in the whole world. And that leads me on to not just the influence that these people clearly have, and they do, and you're quite right, you know, one should be able to make one's own mind up about clothes. But the fact of the matter is that people are rather sheep-like, and they will, you know, they will latch on to whatever Victoria Beckham might be wearing, or, you know, one of the many other celebrities, and just go along on the same tram lines. But what about the fashion and very, very young children? I'm thinking, I mean, I have three daughters, 17-year-old and a 13-year-old and a 9-year-old, and it's been interesting following their progress over the years and how they, at a younger and younger age, they become more and more aware of what they look like.
And are you?
Well, I'm saying
that that's because of this television.
There is a dimension to it. Well, this, this is what I want. I mean, there's a dimension to it which suddenly makes them want to be aware of their physicality and sexuality, often without realizing what it is that they're dealing with. And I just wondered what you felt about that, because it is part of this whole world, and it seems to be. For children, anyway, that starting point seems to be getting younger and younger and younger, so that you get, you know, 5-year-olds wanting to, you know, have, you know, very, very fashionable clothes. And I think that, you know, a lot to do with it is that there are, you know, high street stores now like H&M that actually sell very, very inexpensive clothes, and kids look great, Gap and so forth. Mm. But it's not just that. There's a kind of, you know, kids casual look. But my concern is there is that borderline where suddenly you lose the child, and you seem to be losing the child at an earlier and earlier age. I don't know whether that's just pressure, peer pressure, or whether it is,
conspiracy. Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of information out there now. You know, internet and, which... I mean, when you compare it to where we began, which was in this small village in Lancashire, you know, my mother got a monthly magazine delivered, and that was our fashion information. When you, it's 100,000 times more now, I think there was one dress shop in the village, in the town. But it was an extraordinarily Spartan existence, I think, as far as that side of things are concerned. Now, it's international, it's 24 hours, it's constant, it's... So therefore, you know, the generation that is growing up must respond to that information being given out.
Yes.
I don't know whether... I mean, I would always say it's a shame if people lose their childhood. I always think it's a... But then that's possibly because I am the generation I am. Other people would say... It's great to get savvy early on. I have no opinion about that, really, and I don't know who's to blame. I find it quite shocking. I mean, I'm just on this model health inquiry now, and we're banning... I mean, they're going to recommend a ban on underage models.
Yes.
So anybody under 16, they're going to recommend do not appear on London catwalks. And I think... Most of the designers have signed up to this. But I can tell you for a fact that, you know, I've had several model castings over my long career when mothers have come with 13-year-olds and mothers have come and said, you know, give her a chance on you, you know, we know you'll be nice to her, but just let her get out there. And... So where does this fault lie? You know, and it's not that the girl is being pushed out and doesn't want to do it. You know, a 14-year-old girl would actually love to strut down.
Syndrome, like, of course, in the film, it, sunshine,
yes, absolutely.
Exactly the parents, the child.
Yeah, but then you know you follow the whole issue about sexual exploitation, and you know you're dressing up a young girl to look like a woman, and you know there's huge grey danger areas, massive ones. So. I don't know. It's a very sad state of affairs, but it is the state of affairs we are in. And, you know, so for as many TV shows like that, we should maybe, you know, ask people to go and see an exhibition.
Yes.
Or read a book.
Okay, touching on another aspect of what you do and what we all do, you know, there's greater pressure on people now to think about the planet and so forth and the people in it. I was thinking more in terms of the sourcing of your manufacturing and materials and so forth, and how that fits into your scheme of things. Because there has been, I mean, certainly not now, but in not so many years ago, there were a lot of manufacturing done in the Far East, and it turned out that people were kind of locked in machine rooms and all that sort of thing, which is pretty horrible.
I'm sure with that's still the
big,
case.
With these big chains.
Yeah, I'm sure that's still the case. But, you know, when you get high street shops selling coats for £15, what do you imagine? How do you imagine they're going to actually ever be able to make anything for that price? You know, if you pay £1.99 for a chicken, it's not going to be a chicken.
Absolutely.
You know, and neither is a £15 coat.
Yeah.
So, on the one hand, of course, we condemn and say this is completely shocking and people shouldn't live like that. On the other hand, we have an avaricious appetite for £15 coats. So, you know, there's for us, I've always used eco cotton. You know, ever since we started, you know, cotton is a difficult fabric to make. It's difficult to farm. And we've also just done involved with a charity that's trying to stamp out child labour in Uzbekistan that are farming cotton. So wherever you turn, you know, there's a wrong thing happening that you're not going to be able to put right.
Mm.
That's not to say one shouldn't have a collective responsibility, and that's not to say one does have a collective responsibility. We do a diffusion range. It does cost what it costs. It is probably still too expensive. It means we sell less because I can't do the £15 coats, and you know my coats, even in the cheaper range, will be £150 because it's reasonably manufactured and we pay a decent price for them.
Mm.
And that's the only thing that I can do. We don't necessarily buy fabrics that are completely green, clean. I'm sure anybody who wanted to delve could find something ghastly in a woodpile somewhere, but nothing one can do about that. Of course, there is something one can do. One can actually carry on in what, you know, doing one's little tunnel correctly, and hopefully everybody else doing their own little tunnel correctly will eventually give the right message out. But I can't stand outside a high street shop and say, don't buy this, it's wrong.
No.
Because everybody must know that it's wrong.
Yes, yes.
But
they just close their eyes to it.
They close their eyes and they buy the thing. The other thing that's important is that I am very pleased about the choice of merchandise that is available. You know, if there were a way to get £15 coats in, I would be very happy about that, because I don't think one should naturally assume that everybody, you know, I'm very pleased that there is a choice of merchandise to any economic group, you know, so that it's not difficult, even if you, but I, instead of buying the £15 coat, I'd rather they went and shopped at Oxfam.
Yes.
You know, which
well, a lot of, I mean, that,
but
know,
they
kids
wouldn't
do.
A lot of kids
go to
do
these retro
yeah
shops and
yeah
fantastic
yeah.
I want to end really by saying that, you know, you've had this very successful, I'm sure it's had its bumpy periods as well in the fashion business, it's par for the course. And there'll be a lot of young hopeful designers that want to enter into the world of fashion. And I just wondered if you had any little nuggets that might help them, because you've had your own difficulties throughout your life and you bounce back, you know, some would say, you know, remarkably against all odds when you were very young. And I won't go into your accident, but it's a fundamental thing. And clearly, I wondered whether it was the creativity that pulled you through. And when I think of students who get very miserable and low down, it would be just very nice to hear whether you had any little nuggets, apart from work hard.
Well, actually, yeah, there's the key, isn't it? But also, you know, I think I've been privileged to find something that I absolutely love. And, you know, even in the really hard moments, you do know that you love it still. And I think that actually wipes away all the bad bits, because you are then ready to do another lot. I think you have to have a fairly positive attitude. You know, I suppose I am an optimist. I suppose I am. And I mean, you mentioned the accident. I did have a car accident, and that really did shape, you know, change my life, and it changed the way I thought about things. But when something like that has happened, which is probably the worst thing that could have happened to me, I mean, I can't imagine anything worse. Hopefully nothing worse will happen. Then there's nothing you can do about it. Absolutely nothing you can do about it, except go forward. But that's not to say that I just do this on my own, you know. I at that time, there was a team of people working on me and with me, you know, to pull me through it. And I do realise that you can't do things on your own. I mean, we are a very small team, but I would never, ever say that I did this whole thing on my own, because I don't do it without my team. I mean, it's... And that relationship with other people counts for a lot. And as a designer, I think you often have to be all things to all men, you know. You have to be a creative force, obviously. You have to be the stimulating force. You have to excite people. You have to know when to keep, you know that people who work for you also have to be appreciated too, and that you're just a part of a team that makes things happen. And an idea that's in your head is a joy to share with people who are responsive to your ideas, and really that's been a privilege to do. So if you hate it, don't do it. Really do something else.
Okay, well, thank you for sharing all that with us. Thank you very much, Betty Jackson.
Pleasure.